and shut her eyes. Well, she told herself. She would have a talk with Hatsue when the girl came back from wandering aimlessly around the camp. She would put an end to this business. 3 hours before dinner, a group of San Pedro boys knocked on the door of her room. They had with them tools and scraps of lumber, and they were prepared, they said, to build for the Imadas whatever was wanted, shelves, a chest of drawers, chairs. She recognized all of them as the sons of island families, the Tanakas, the Kados, the Matsuis, the Miyamotos, and she told them, yes, she could use all of those things. And the boys set about working in the lee of the barrack, measuring and cutting and sawing while the wind blew. Kabuo Miyamoto came inside and nailed up brackets while Fujiko sat on a cot with her arms crossed and the letter from the Hakujin boy behind her back. "There are some scraps of tin at the side of the block kitchen," Kabuo Miyamoto said to her. "We can nail them over those knot holes in the floor. They'll do a better job than tar paper." "Tar paper tears like that," answered Fujiko in the English Kabuo used. "And it not help keep cold out." Kabuo nodded and went back to work, his hammer striking efficiently. "How is your family?" Fujiko said. "Your mother, your father? How everybody?" "My father is ill," Kabuo answered. "The camp food is bad for his stomach." He paused to slip another nail from his pocket. "And you?" he said. "How are all of the Imada women?"
"Dusty," said Fujiko. "We eat dust."
At this moment, Hatsue came through the door, her face reddened by the cold outside, and tugged the scarf from her head. Kabuo Miyamoto stopped his work for a moment to gaze at her while she shook her hair free. "Hello," he said. "It's good to see you." Hatsue tossed her hair once more, gathered it in her hands swiftly, and smoothed it down the back of her head. Then she stuffed her hands in her overcoat and sat down beside her mother. "Hello," she said, but nothing more. They sat for a moment, watching in silence while Kabuo Miyamoto went about his work. He sat on his shins with his back to them, tapping carefully with a hammer. Another of the carpenters came through the door with a stack of freshly sawed pine boards. Kabuo Miyamoto laid each on the brackets and tested each with a level. "They're straight," he announced. "They should work out well. I'm sorry we couldn't do better."
"They are very nice," said Fujiko. "It's kind of you. Our thanks."
"We're going to build you 6 chairs, said Kabuo, looking at Hatsue now. "We're going to build you 2 chests of drawers and a table you can eat on. We'll have them to you in a few days' time, as soon as we can get them built."
"Thank you," said Fujiko. "You're very kind."
"We're glad to do it for you," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "It isn't any trouble at all." Still holding his hammer, he smiled at Hatsue, and she dropped her eyes to her lap. He slipped the hammer into a cloth ring on his pants, then picked up his level and measuring tape. "Goodbye, Mrs. Imada," he said. "Goodbye, Hatsue. It's good to see you."
"Our thanks again," said Fujiko. "Your help is greatly appreciated."
When the door had shut, she reached behind her and handed Hatsue the letter.
"Here," she spat, "your mail. I don't know how you could have been so deceitful. I'll never understand it, Hatsue."
She had planned to discuss the matter right there and then, but she understood suddenly that the strength of her bitterness might prevent her from saying what she really meant.
"You will not write again to this boy or accept his letters," she said sternly from the doorway.
The girl sat with a letter in her hand, tears gathering in her eyes.
"I'm sorry," Hatsue said. "Forgive me, mother. I've deceived you, and I've always known it."
"Deceiving me," said Fujiko in Japanese, "is only half of it, daughter. You have deceived yourself, too."
Then Fujiko went out into the wind. She walked to the post office and told the clerk there to hold all mail for the Yamada family. From now on, she herself would come for it. It should be handed to her only. That afternoon, she sat in the mess hall and wrote her own letter addressed to the parents of the boy Ishmael Chambers. She told them about the hollow tree in the woods, and how Ishmael and Hatsue had deceived the world for a number of years successfully. She revealed to them the contents of the letter their son had written to her daughter. Her daughter, she said, would not be writing back, now or at any time in the future. Whatever had been between them was over, and she apologized for her daughter's role in it. She hoped that the boy would see his future in a new light and give no more thought to Hatsue. She understood, she wrote, that they were only children. She knew children were often foolish. Still, both of these young people were culpable and must look to themselves now, examine their souls, consider this a matter of conscience. It was no crime to find oneself attracted to another, she wrote, or to believe what one felt was love. The dishonor lay instead in concealing from one's family the nature of one's affections. She hoped that the parents of Ishmael Chambers would understand her position. She did not wish for any further communication to pass between her daughter and their son. She had expressed her feelings clearly to her daughter and asked her not to write to the boy or accept his letters in the future. She added that she admired the Chambers family and had great respect for the San Pedro Review. She wished them well, all of them. She showed this letter to Hatsue when it was folded and ready to go in its envelope. The girl read it over, twice, slowly, with her left cheek resting on her left hand. When she was done, she held it tightly in her lap and looked blandly at her mother. Her face, strangely, was drained of emotion. She had the look of one exhausted from the inside, too tired to feel. Fujiko saw that she had gotten older in the 3 weeks since they'd left San Pedro. Her daughter was suddenly grown up, a woman, weary from the inside. Her daughter had suddenly grown hardened. "You don't have to send this," she said now to Fujiko. "I wasn't going to write him again anyway. I was on the train coming down here, and all I could think about was Ishmael Chambers and whether I should write him a letter, whether I loved him any more." "Love," spat Fujiko. "You not know about love. You—" "I'm 18, replied Hatsue. "I'm old enough. Stop thinking of me as a little girl. You have to understand, I've grown up." Fujiko removed her glasses carefully, and, as was her habit, rubbed her eyes. "On the train," she said. "What you decide?" "Nothing at first," said Hatsue. "I couldn't think very clearly. There were too many things to think about, Mother. I was too depressed to think." "And now," said Fujiko, "what now?" "I'm done with him," said Hatsue. "We were children together. We played on the beach. And it turned out to be something bigger. But he isn't the husband for me, Mother. I've known that all along. Whenever we were together, it seemed like something was wrong. I always knew deep inside it was wrong. I felt it down inside somewhere. This feeling like I loved him and at the same time couldn't love him. I was always confused every day, right from the beginning. He's a good person, Mother. You know his family. He's really a very good person. But none of that matters, does it? I wanted to tell him it was over, Mother. But I was leaving. It was all confused. I couldn't get the words out, and besides, I didn't really know what I felt. I was confused. There was too much to think about. I needed to straighten it all out."
"And is it straightened out now, Hatsue? Is it straightened?"
The girl was silent for a moment. She ran a hand through her hair and let it fall. Then the other hand, too.
"It's straight," she said. "I have to tell him. I have to put an end to it."
Fujiko took her letter from her daughter's lap and ripped it neatly down the middle.
"Write your own letter," she said in Japanese. "Tell him the truth about things. Put all of this in your history. Tell him the truth so you can move forward. Put this Hakujin boy away now."
In the morning, Sumiko was reminded of the importance of revealing nothing about this episode. She promised her mother she would keep silent. Fujiko took Hatsue's letter to the post office and paid the postage on it. She licked the envelope shut herself, and because the notion took hold of her suddenly, a kind of caprice and nothing more, she pressed the stamp on upside down before putting the letter in the mailbox. When Kabuo Miyamoto brought his chests of drawers, Fujiko asked him to stay for tea, and he sat with them for more than 2 hours, and again on the next night when he delivered the table, and on the following night when he delivered the chairs. Then on the fourth night he came to their door with his hat in his hand and asked Hatsue if she would go for a walk with him underneath the stars. She said no on that occasion, and did not speak to him for another 3 weeks. And yet she saw that he was polite and handsome, the clear-eyed son of strawberry farmers, and anyway she couldn't grieve over Ishmael Chambers until the end of her days. When the time came, a few months later, that Ishmael was mostly a persistent ache buried beneath the surface of her daily life, she spoke to Kabuo Miyamoto in the mess hall and sat beside him to eat lunch. She admired his impeccable table manners and the graciousness of his smile. He spoke softly to her, asked her about her dreams, and when she said she wanted an island strawberry farm, he said he wanted the same thing precisely, and told her about how his family's 7 acres would soon be transferred to his name. When the war was over, he planned to farm strawberries back home on San Pedro Island. When she kissed him for the first time, she felt the grip of her sadness, how it seized more tightly around her, and how different his mouth was from Ishmael's. He smelled of earth, and his body's strength was far greater than her own. She found she couldn't move within the circle of his arms and struggled against him, breathless. "You'll have to be more gentle," she'd whispered.
"I'll try," Kabuo had answered.
Chapter 16. Ishmael Chambers, trained as a marine rifleman with 750 other recruits at Paris Island, South Carolina, in the late summer of 1942. In October, he fell ill with fever and dysentery and was hospitalized for 11 days, during which he lost considerable weight and passed his time reading Atlanta newspapers and playing chess with other boys. Sprawled in his bed with his knees up and his hands behind his head, he listened to radio news accounts of the war and studied the diagrams of troop movements in the papers with a lazy, unruffled fascination. He grew a mustache for 6 days, then shaved it, then let it grow again. Through almost every afternoon, he slept, waking in time to feel dusk settle in and to watch the light die beyond the window 3 beds away to his right. Other boys came and went, but he stayed. The war wounded came to the hospital, but convalesced on 2 other floors he had no access to. He lived in his T-shirt and underwear, and the smell from the open window was of dying leaves and of rain in the dirt and turned fields. And it began to seem to him strangely apt that he lay so many thousand miles from home, and was so alone in his sickness. It was the kind of suffering, after all, he'd yearned for during the last 5 months, since receiving Hatsue's letter. It was an easy, sleepy kind of languid fever, and so long as he did not try to move too much or exert himself unnecessarily, he could live this way indefinitely. He surrounded himself with his illness thoroughly, and embedded himself in it. In October he trained a second time, as a radio man, and was sent to a staging area on the North Island of New Zealand as part of the 2nd Marine Division. They assigned him to B Company in the 2nd Marine Regiment, 3rd Battalion, and he soon met men who'd been at Guadalcanal, and he replaced a radio operator who'd been shot during the fighting in the Solomons. One night, a lieutenant named Jim Kent recollected how the former radio man had taken an interest in a dead Japanese boy with his pants turned inside out around his muddy ankles. The radio man, a Private Gerald Willis, had propped the boy's penis up by placing a stone under it, then had lain down carefully in the dirt and shot carbine rounds until he'd blown the head of it off. He'd been proud of himself afterward, and had bragged about his aim for a half hour or more, describing for others how the boy's penis had looked with the head of it severed, and how the head itself had looked lying on the ground. Private Willis had been killed 2 days later on patrol, by friendly mortar fire he'd called for at the direction of Lieutenant Kent himself, who'd given the correct coordinates. 7 men in the platoon had died on that occasion, and Kent had lowered himself into a foxhole and watched a Private Wiesner toss a grenade unsuccessfully toward a pillbox, while at the same moment a stream of machine-gun fire caught Wiesner at the waist and forced his viscera out. A piece of it had landed on Kent's forearm, blue, fresh, and glistening. They trained incessantly and practiced landing maneuvers at Hawke Bay, where the tides were bad. Men died during these exercises. Ishmael tried to take maneuvers seriously, but the veterans in his squad went through them hungover or bored or both simultaneously, and their attitude of indifference had its influence. On Liberty he drank ale and at other times gin with boys who, like him, were new to the war, and they played pool in Wellington together. Even at those times, drunk at 1 o'clock in the morning, leaning against his pool cue in the smoky light while another boy lined up a shot and a Wellington band played dance tunes he didn't recognize, Ishmael felt a peculiar detachment from everybody. He was numb to it all, uninterested in drinking and pool and other people. And the more drunk he became, the more lucid his mind was, and the colder he felt toward everyone. He did not understand the laughter of his compatriots, or their ease, or anything else about them. What were they doing here, drinking and shouting at 1 o'clock in the morning in a country so far from the homes they knew? What were they so feverishly happy about? One morning, in a heavy downpour, he wandered back to his Wellington hotel at 4:30 and lay down heavily with his writing tablet to compose a letter to his parents. After he'd written to them, he wrote one to Hatsue. And then he took both letters and ripped them up and fell asleep, with some of the pieces jammed into his coat pocket and the rest scattered across the floor. He slept with his shoes on and at 6:15 awoke to vomit in the toilet closet down the hall. On the first day of November, the 2nd Division left Wellington, presumably on maneuvers at Hawke Bay again, but ending up instead at Noumea on the French island of New Caledonia. By the 13th, Ishmael's regiment was on board the Haywood, a transport ship traveling with more than half of the 3rd Fleet, frigates, destroyers, light and heavy cruisers, half a dozen battleships, all headed for an unknown destination. On the second day, his company was assembled on the top deck, and told that they were moving toward Tarawa Atoll, where they would go ashore at Baecio, a strongly defended island. A major stood in front of them, sucking on his pipe stem, with his right elbow tucked into his left palm. The idea, he explained, was to let the Navy obliterate the place. It was less than 2 square miles of coral sand. Then wade in and mop up the leftovers. The Jap commander, he said, had boasted that Baecio could not be successfully invaded by even a force of 1 million soldiers with 1,000 years to do battle. The major pulled his pipe from his mouth and proclaimed the Japanese commander laughable in this regard. He predicted a battle lasting 2 days at most, with few, if any, marine casualties. It was a matter the Navy guns would take care of, he repeated, a tailor-made place for shipboard artillery to do the dirty work. On the night of the 19th, a quarter moon rose over the sea while the fleet stood 7 miles off Tarawa. Ishmael ate a last meal on the Haywood's messing deck with Ernest Testaverde, a boy he liked, an anti-tank gunner from Delaware. They ate steak and eggs, fried potatoes and coffee, and then Testaverde put down his mess tray and took a pad of paper and a pen from his pocket. He began to write a letter home. "You better write one yourself," he said to Ishmael. "Last chance you're going to get, you know." "Last chance?" answered Ishmael. "There's no one I really want to write to in that case. "It isn't up to you," said Testaverde. "Just in case, write a letter." Ishmael went below and got his pad of paper. He sat on the top deck with his back against the stanchion and composed a letter to Hatsue. From where he sat, he could see 20 other men, all of them, writing intently. It was warm for so late at night, and the men all looked comfortable with their collars open and the sleeves of their uniform shirts rolled up. Ishmael told Hatsue how he was about to go ashore on an island in the Central Pacific, and that his job was to kill people who looked like her, as many of them as he could. "What did she think about that?" he wrote. "How did that make her feel?" He said that his numbness was a terrible thing. He didn't feel anything except that he looked forward to killing as many Japs as possible. He was angry at them and wanted their deaths, all of them, he wrote. He felt hatred. He explained to her the nature of his hatred and told her she was as responsible for it as anyone in the world. In fact, he hated her now. He didn't want to hate her, but since this was a last letter, he felt bound to tell the truth as completely as he could. He hated her with everything in his heart, he wrote. And it felt good to him to write it in just that way. "I hate you with all my heart," he wrote. "I hate you, Hatsue. I hate you always." It was at this point that he ripped the sheet from his writing pad, crumpled it, and threw it into the sea. He watched it floating on the water for a few seconds, then threw his pad in after it. At 3:20 in the morning, wide awake in his bunk, Ishmael heard the order delivered to the troop hold. "All Marines lay topside to your debarkation stations." He sat up and watched Ernest Testaverde lace his boots, and then began to lace his own, stopping once to drink from his canteen. "Dry mouth," he said to Ernest. "You want some water before we die?" "Lace up," said Ernest. "Get topside." They went up, dragging their gear along with them, and Ishmael felt wide awake now. There were already more than 300 men squatting and kneeling on the top deck of the Haywood, rearranging their equipment in the dark: sea rations, canteens, entrenching tools, gas masks, rounds of ammunition, steel helmets. There had been no firing yet, and it didn't feel so much like war, another nighttime exercise in tropical waters. Ishmael heard the whine of the landing craft plummeting over the sheaves of the boat blocks. Then men were going overboard into them, snaking their way down the cargo nets with packs on their backs and their helmets strapped on and timing their lunges to coincide with the bobbing of the boats below. Ishmael watched a half-dozen Navy corpsmen busily packing medical field kits and stacking ambulatory litters. This was something he hadn't seen on maneuvers, and he pointed it out to Testaverde, who shrugged and went back to counting anti-tank rounds. Ishmael turned on his TBX, listened for a moment to the static in the headphones, then switched it off and waited. He did not want to strap it to his back too early, then have to stand around with its weight burdening him until his turn came to crawl down the cargo net. Sitting beside his gear, peering out to sea, he tried to make out Peccio, but the island could not be seen. Each of the LCVP landing craft that had left the Haywood in the past half-hour appeared as a dark spot against the water, though. Ishmael counted 36 of them. The 3 squads of 3rd Platoon were briefed on the top deck by a 1st Lieutenant Pavelman from San Antonio, who explained in detail the role of B Company in the larger scheme of things. He had before him a relief model of the island, made out of 3 square sections of rubber, and with a pointer began to point out its topographical features, doing so with no flourishes. Amtraks, he said, were going in first, followed by waves of Higgins boats. There was going to be air cover, dive bombers and Hellcats on strafing runs, and B-24s from out of the Ellis Islands, right up to the point of attack. B Company would go ashore at a place called Beach Red 2, he said, and the mortar section would place itself at the disposal of the weapons platoon leader, a 2nd Lieutenant Pratt, for the purpose of establishing a base of fire. 2nd Platoon would come in simultaneously on Pratt's right and advance over the seawall behind its light machine guns, then collect on higher ground and move inland. There were bunkers and pillboxes, said Lieutenant Pavelman, directly south of Beach Red 2. Marine intelligence was furthermore of the opinion that the Jap command bunker was perhaps located in this area, possibly at the eastern end of the airfield. 2nd Platoon should look for it and fix the location of air vents for the demolition teams, who would come in directly behind. 3 minutes after 2nd went ashore, 3rd Platoon, Ishmael's, would beach and come in close, or, according to the judgment of Lieutenant Bellows, go to the support of whichever platoon appeared to have made a solid advance. The platoon could expect support from K Company, which was scheduled to come in with the headquarters group and a heavy machine-gun platoon just behind the 3rd. They would land from more Amtraks, which could be used against the seawall. The theory, said Lieutenant Pavelman, was to come in fast and hard with full support behind the initial wave of riflemen. "Another name for it is Suckers First," someone in 3rd Platoon called out bitterly. But no one laughed at this. Pavelman pushed on mechanically with his briefing. Rifle platoons, he explained, would cut a careful but persistent advance, followed by reinforcements in the 2nd wave, command and support in the 3rd wave, then more rifle companies and more support and command until the beachhead was well established. Then, with his hands at his belt, Lieutenant Pavelman called on a chaplain Thomas to lead them in a recitation of the 23rd Psalm and in the singing of "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." When they were done, everyone fell silent on the deck, and the chaplain called on the men to contemplate their relationship to God and Jesus. "That's fine," a soldier called out in the darkness. "But look here, I'm an atheist, sir, the exception to the rule that there ain't no atheists in foxholes or firefights, and I'm going to stay a goddamn atheist to the goddamn end, goddammit." "So be it," Chaplain Thomas answered softly. "And may God bless you just the same, my friend." Ishmael began to wonder how any of this would direct him once he hit the beach. He had listened to Lieutenant Pavelman as closely as he could, but had not discerned the relationship between his words and the specific direction in which his own feet should move once he landed on Becchio. Why was he going there? To do what, exactly? The chaplain was passing out pieces of lucky candy and rolls of military toilet paper, and Ishmael took one of each from him, chiefly because everyone else had done so. The chaplain, a Colt 45 strapped to his belt, encouraged him to take more of the candy. "It's good stuff," he said. "Come on." They were peppermints, and Ishmael popped one in his mouth, then strapped his radio onto his back and pulled himself into a standing position. The entire weight of his equipment, he guessed, was more than 85 pounds. It was not easy to crawl down the cargo net so loaded, but Ishmael had been able to practice on maneuvers and had taught himself to relax. Halfway down, he spit out the peppermint and leaned out over the water. A whistling had begun to sound in his ears, growing louder by the second. He turned to look, and at the same moment a shell plunged into the sea 75 feet to stern. A spray of salt water broke across the boat, dousing the marines there. The phosphorescence boiled up green and luminous against the darkness. The boy next to Ishmael, a private Jim Harvey from Carson City, Nevada, swore softly under his breath twice, then leaned in against the net. "Shit," he said. "A goddamn shell. I don't believe this shit."
"Me neither," said Ishmael.
"I thought they blew the shit out of this place," Jim Harvey complained. "I thought they dusted all the big guns off before we had to go in. Jesus fucking Christ," he added.
"The big boys are still coming out from the Ellis Islands," Walter Bennett down the net pointed out. "They're going to dust the Japs with daisy cutters before we ever hit the sand."
"That's bullshit," said another voice. "There aren't going to be no daisy cutters coming. You're a motherfucking dreamer, Walter."
"A fucking Jap shell," Jim Harvey said. "God damn it to shit.
But another shell came whistling down and slammed into the water 100 yards in front of them, sending up a momentary geyser.
"Fuckers!" Private Harvey yelled. "I thought they softened the bastards up, thought we was just mopping up."
"They've been fucking up for days, lobbing him long," a boy named Larry Jackson explained calmly. "All that softening up bullshit don't mean a rat's ass. They fucked it all up, and now we're going in, and there's all sorts of fucking Jap fire."
"Jesus!" said Jim Harvey. "I can't believe this bullshit. What the fuck is going on here?"
The LCVP pushed on with 3rd Platoon aboard. Ishmael could hear the whistling of shells now distantly across the water. He sat low beneath a plywood gunwale a Navy crew had jury-rigged during downtime in Noumea. He was weighted down now heavily by his pack, with his helmet pulled to his brow. He could hear Jim Harvey chattering hopefully,
"The fucker's been pounding them up for days, right? There ain't nothing left there but sand and bullshit and a whole lot of little Jap pieces. That's what everyone's been hearing. Matson read it off the radio, and Bledsoe was right there in the room with him. It's no bullshit. They fucking dusted him."
The seas, as it turned out, contrary to all plans, were running high and choppy. Ishmael did not stand up well on high seas and had become addicted to Dramamine. He swallowed, too, with water from his belt canteen and peered out over the plywood gunwale with his helmet on but not strapped. The boat thrummed under him, and he saw that they were running alongside 3 other landing craft immediately off to the left. He could see the men in the boat next to his. One of them had lit a cigarette and the glow of its tip was visible, though he tucked it down inside his cradled palm. Ishmael lowered himself against his pack again, shut his eyes, and put his fingers in his ears. He tried not to think about any of it. For 3 hours they stood off Baccio. When the formation was ready, at 07:30, they began to move steadily forward, the waves coming in constantly over the gunwales and soaking everybody on board. The island became visible as a low black line almost on the horizon. Ishmael stood to stretch his legs now. There were fires glowing all up and down Baccio, and a man beside him with a waterproof watch was attempting to time the battleship salvos being fired on the island. On the other side, 2 men were complaining bitterly about an Admiral Hill who was in charge of things and who had timed matters such that they were going in at daylight instead of under cover of darkness. They could see that the Navy was firing heavily. Black smoke rose from the island in great billows, and this began to have a positive influence on the disposition of 3rd Platoon.
"There ain't going to be nothing left of the fuckers," Private Harvey asserted. "Them 5-inch guns will do the trick. They're pounding the shit out of them."
15 minutes later, they ran the big current at the entrance to Tarawa Lagoon. They bobbed past 2 destroyers, the Dashiell and the Ringgold, both of which were firing in waves at the beach. The noise of it was deafening, louder than anything Ishmael had ever heard. Strapping his helmet on now, he decided he was done looking over the gunwale. He had peered up once and seen three amphibious tractors going up on the beach far ahead. They were taking a lot of machine gun fire. One fell down into a shell hole, another caught fire and halted. There were no more dive bombers coming in at all, and the B-24s had not appeared. The best thing to do was to tuck down, strap up, and keep well out of the line of fire. Ishmael had somehow arrived at the war moment little boys are prone to dream about. He was storming a beach. He was a Marine radio man. And he felt like shitting his pants, literally. He could feel his rectum puckering. "Holy shit," Jim Harvey was saying. "God damn it to hell. The motherfuckers, God damn those assholes, the fucking shitheads, God damn it, this ain't right." The squad leader, a man named Rich Hinkle, from Wairika, California, who had made Ishmael an excellent chess partner in New Zealand, was the first among them to die. The landing craft ground up suddenly on the reef. They were still more than 500 yards from the beach, and the men sat looking at one another for 30 seconds or more while machine gun fire pinged off the LCVP's port side. "There's bigger stuff coming," Hinkle yelled above the din. "We'd better get the hell out of here. Let's move it. Move! Let's go!"
"You first," somebody answered.
Hinkle went over the starboard gunwale and dropped down into the water. Men began to follow him, including Ishmael Chambers, who was maneuvering his 85-pound pack over the side when Hinkle was shot in the face and went down. And then the man just behind him was shot, too, and the top of his head came off. Ishmael wrestled his pack into the lagoon and splashed in hard behind it. He submerged himself for as long as he could. Came up only for a single breath. He could see small arms fire flashing along the shore, then went deep again. When he came up, he saw that everybody, the ammo carriers, the demolitions guys, the machine gunners, everybody, they were all dropping everything into the water and going under like Ishmael. He swam back behind the LCVP with three dozen other Marines. The Navy coxswain was still exerting himself, cursing and ramming the throttle back and forth to free the landing craft from the reef. Lieutenant Bellows was screaming at the men on board who had refused to go over the gunwales. "Fuck you, Bellows," somebody kept saying. "You go first," screamed someone else. Ishmael recognized the voice of Private Harvey, now at a hysterical pitch. The LCVP took more fire, and the crowd of men who had crouched behind it began to wade toward shore. Ishmael kept to the middle of the group, swimming and keeping low, breast-stroking, and tried to think of himself as a dead Marine floating harmlessly in Baccio's lagoon, a corpse borne by the current. The men were in chest-high water now, some of them carrying rifles above their heads, and they were dropping into seas already tinged pink by the blood of other men in front of them. Ishmael saw men go lurching down, saw the machine gun fire whipping the water's surface, and lowered himself even farther. In the shallows ahead of him, a Private Newland stood up to run for the seawall, and then another man he didn't know made a run for it and was shot dead in the surf. And then a third man ran for it. The fourth, Eric Bledsoe, was shot in the knee and lay down again in the shallows. Ishmael stopped and watched the fifth and sixth men draw fire, then gathered himself and thrashed out of the water while the men ahead of him ran for it. All three of them made the seawall unharmed and crouched behind the coconut logs, watching Eric Bledsoe. His knee had been shot away. Ishmael saw Eric Bledsoe bleed to death. 50 yards away, he lay in the surf, pleading in a soft voice for help. "Oh, shit," he said. "Help me, you guys. Come on, you guys. Fucking help me, please." Eric had grown up in Delaware with Ernest Testaverde. They'd gotten drunk together a lot in Wellington. Robert Newland wanted to run out to save him, but Lieutenant Bellows held him back. There was nothing to be done about it, Bellows pointed out. There was far too much gunfire for something like that. The upshot of it all would be two dead men. And everyone silently agreed. Ishmael pushed his body up against the seawall. He was not going to run down the beach again to drag a wounded man to safety, though a part of him wanted to try. What could he have done about it anyway? His equipment was sunk in the lagoon. He couldn't even offer Eric Bledsoe a bandage, much less save his life. He sat there and watched Eric roll over in the surf so that his face was pointing toward the sun. His legs were only partly in the water, and Ishmael could see plainly where one of them had come off and was moving with the undulations of the surf. The boy bled to death, and then his leg floated away a few feet on the waves while Ishmael crouched behind the seawall. At 10 o'clock he was still there, unarmed and without a job to do, hunkered down with hundreds of other men who had come ashore and been shot at. There were plenty more dead Marines on the beach now, and plenty more of the wounded, too. And the men behind the seawall tried not to listen when they moaned or called out for help. Then a sergeant from J Company, from out of nowhere, it seemed, was suddenly standing above them on the seawall with a cigarette hanging from the corner of his mouth, calling them a bunch of chicken shits. He berated them relentlessly, a stream of invective characterizing them as the sorts of cowards who ought to have your balls chewed off real slow and painful-like when this goddamn battle is over. Men who'd let other men do the dirty work to save your own sorry asses. Men who aren't men at all, but cornhole fuckers and jack-off artists with half-inch hard-ons on those days once a year when you can get your sorry dicks to stand at half-mast. And so on and so forth, while the men below pleaded with him to take cover and save himself. He refused, and was shot through the spine with a shell that ripped open his shirt front and dropped some of his guts onto the beach. The sergeant had no time to be surprised, and simply fell over, face first, into the sand, and squarely on top of his own intestines. Nobody said anything. A tractor at last breached a hole in the seawall, and a few men began to go through. All of them were shot immediately. Ishmael was commandeered to help dig free a half-track that had been deposited on Becho by a tank lighter and had promptly buried itself. He dug on his knees with an entrenching tool while the man beside him threw up in the sand before lying down with his helmet across his face and fainting. A radio man from K Company had set up against the seawall and was railing loudly about interference. Every time battleship guns were fired offshore, even the static died out, he complained. He couldn't raise anybody. Ishmael realized in the early afternoon that the sweetish smell coming at him from off the beach was the odor of dead Marines. He, too, vomited, then drank the last of his water. As far as he knew, no one else in his squad was even alive anymore. He had not seen any of them in over 3 hours, but he had been given a carbine, an ammo pack, and a field machete by a crew of cargo handlers moving down the wall with resupply orders. He field-stripped the carbine, it was full of sand, and cleaned it as carefully as he could under the conditions, sitting against the base of the seawall with his steel helmet unstrapped. He was sitting there like that, with the trigger assembly in hand, dabbing at it with the tail of his shirt, when a new wave of Amtraks came up on the beach and began drawing mortar fire. Ishmael watched them with interest for a while, men spilling out and falling to the sand, some dead, some wounded, some screaming as they ran, then lowered his head and, refusing to look, went back to cleaning his carbine. He was still there, huddled in the same place with his carbine in hand, his machete in a sheath that hung from his belt, when darkness fell 4 hours later. A colonel came down the beach with his entourage, exhorting the non-coms and junior officers to reform and improvise squads. At 2100 hours, he said, less than 20 minutes from now, every man there was going over the top. Anyone who stayed behind would be court-martialed. It was time, he added, to act like Marines. The colonel moved on, and a Lieutenant Dorper from K Company asked Ishmael where his squad was and what the hell he thought he was doing, dug in by himself against the seawall. Ishmael explained how he had lost his equipment going over the gunwale of an LCVP, and how everyone around him had died or been wounded. He didn't know where anyone was. Lieutenant Dorper listened impatiently, then told Ishmael to pick out a man along the wall, and then pick out another, and then some more, until he had himself a squad formed, and then to report to the command post Colonel Freeman had set up beside the buried half-track. He had, he said, no time for bullshit. Ishmael explained matters to 24 boys before he'd gathered enough of a squad. One boy told him to go fuck himself. Another claimed to have an incapacitating leg wound. A third said he'd be along in a minute, but never moved. There was gunfire coming from off the water suddenly, and Ishmael surmised that a Jap sniper had swum out and was manning the machine gun left behind on an Amtrak destroyed in the lagoon. The seawall was no longer safe. Moving down the wall, staying low and talking rapidly to people, he came at last on Ernest Testaverde, who was returning fire over the coconut logs, with his gun held high and his head down. "Hey," said Ishmael, "Jesus!" "Chambers," said Ernest, "Jesus fucking Christ!" "Where is everybody?" asked Ishmael. "What about Jackson and those guys?" "I saw Jackson get hit," Ernest answered. "All the demolition guys and the mine detector guys got hit coming up onto the beach. And Walter," he added, "and Jim Harvey. And that guy Hedges, I saw him go down. And Murray and Baring got hit, too. They all got hit in the water." "So did Hinkle," said Ishmael. "And Eric Bledsoe, his leg came off. And Fitz, he got hit on the beach. I saw him go down. Bellows made it. But I don't know where he is. Newland, too. Where are those guys?" Ernest Testaverde didn't answer. He pulled at his helmet strap and set his carbine down. "Bledsoe?" he said. "You sure?" Ishmael nodded. "He's dead." "His leg came off?" said Ernest. Ishmael sat down with his back to the seawall. He did not want to talk about Eric Bledsoe or remember how he had died. It was difficult to know what the point would be of talking about such a thing. There was no point to anything. That was clear. He couldn't think straight about anything that had happened since the landing craft had ground onto the coral reef. The situation he found himself in now had the sodden quality of a dream in which events repeated themselves. He was dug in against the seawall, and then he found himself there again, and again he was still dug in beneath the seawall. Occasionally a flare lit things well enough so that he saw the details of his own hands. He was weary and thirsty, and he could not really focus, and the adrenaline had died inside of him. He wanted to live, he knew that now, but everything else was unclear. He could not recollect his reason for being there, why he had enlisted to fight in the Marines, what the point of it was. "Yeah," he said. "Bledsoe's dead." "God damn it," answered Ernest Testaverde. He kicked the first log in the seawall twice, then a third time, then a fourth. Ishmael Chambers turned away from him. At 2100 hours, they went over the seawall along with 300 other men. They were met by mortar and machine gun fire from straight ahead in the battered palm trees. Ishmael never saw Ernest Testaverde get hit. Later he found out, on making inquiries, that Ernest had been found with a hole in his head roughly the size of a man's fist. Ishmael himself was hit in the left arm, squarely in the middle of his biceps. The muscle tore when the round entered, a single round from a Nambu machine gun, and the bone cracked jaggedly into 100 splinters that were driven up against his nerves and veins and lodged into the meat of his arm. 9 hours later, when the light came up, he became aware of 2 medical corpsmen kneeling beside the man next to him. The man had been hit in the head, it seemed, and his brains were leaking out around his helmet. Ishmael had maneuvered behind this dead man and taken the sulfur pills and a roll of bandages from the medical kit at his belt. He'd wrapped his arm and had used the weight of his body to keep his blood from spilling out. "It's okay," one of the corpsmen told Ishmael. "We're bringing up a litter team and a squad of bearers. The beach is secured. Everything's fine. We're going to get you shipboard, pronto." "Fucking Japs," said Ishmael. Later, he lay on the deck of some ship or other, 7 miles out to sea from Baccio. One boy in the middle of rows and rows of wounded. And the boy on the litter to his left died from the shrapnel that had pierced his liver. On the other side was a boy with buck teeth who'd been shot squarely in the thighs and groin. The blood had soaked his khaki pants. The boy couldn't speak and lay with his back arched. Every few seconds he groaned mechanically between forced, shallow breaths. Ishmael asked him once if he was all right, but the boy only went on with his groaning. He died 10 minutes before the bearers came around to take him down to surgery. Ishmael lost his arm on a shipboard operating table to a pharmacist's mate who had done only 4 amputations in his career, all of them in the past few hours. The mate used a handsaw to square up the bone and cauterized the stump unevenly so that the wound healed more slowly than it would have otherwise, and the scar tissue left behind was thick and coarse. Ishmael had not been fully anesthetized, and awoke to see his arm where it had been dropped in a corner on top of a pile of blood-soaked dressings. 10 years later, he would still dream of that. The way his own fingers curled against the wall. How white and distant his arm looked. Though nevertheless he recognized it there, a piece of trash on the floor. Somebody saw him staring at it and gave an order, and the arm was scooped up inside a towel and dumped into a canvas bin. Somebody else pricked him once again with morphine, and Ishmael told whoever it was that the Japs are the fucking Japs. But he didn't quite know how to finish his words. He didn't quite know what he meant to utter. That fucking goddamn Jap bitch, was all he could think to say. Chapter 17. By 2 o'clock on the first afternoon of the trial, snow had covered all the island roads. A car pirouetted silently while skating on its tires, emerged from this on a transverse angle, and slid to a stop with one headlight thrust into the door of Peterson's grocery, which somebody opened at just the right moment, miraculously, so that no damage was done to car or store. Behind the Amity Harbor Elementary School, a girl of 7, bending over to pack a snowball, was rammed from behind by a boy skidding down a hill on a piece of cardboard box. She broke her right arm, a greenstick fracture. The principal, Eric Carlson, wrapped a blanket around her shoulders and sat her down next to a steam radiator before going out to run his car engine. Then, gingerly peering out through the crescents of glass his defroster had carved from the icy windshield, he drove her down First Hill into town. On Mill Run Road, Mrs. Larson of Skiff Point ran her husband's DeSoto into a ditch. Arne Stolbad overloaded his wood-burning stove and ended up with a chimney fire. The volunteer fire department was called out by a neighbor, but the pumper truck driver, Edgar Paulson, lost traction on Indian Knob Hill and had to halt to put on tire chains. In the meantime, Arne Stolbad's chimney fire expired. When the firemen showed up at last, he expressed to them his delight at having burned clean the flue creosote. At 3 o'clock, 5 school buses left Amity Harbor with their windshield wipers batting ice from the windshields and their headlights casting into the snowfall. High school students walking home hurled snowballs at them. The South Beach bus slid off the road shoulder just beyond Island Center. The school children climbed out and walked home in the snowstorm, with Johnny Katayama, the bus driver, escorting them from behind. As each child turned off toward home, Johnny handed him or her a half-stick of spearmint gum. A boy on a sled that afternoon broke his ankle against the base of a cedar tree. He had not quite understood how to make the thing turn, and the tree had come up on him suddenly. He'd put his foot out to ward it off. A retired dentist, old Doc Cable, slipped hard on the way to his firewood shed. Something in his tailbone twisted when he went down, so that Doc Cable winced and curled fetally in the snow. After a while, he hauled himself up, lurched inside, and reported to his wife through clenched teeth that he'd injured himself. Sarah put him on the couch with a hot water bottle, where he took two aspirins and fell asleep. Two teenagers engaged in a snowball-throwing contest from the dock at Port Jefferson Harbor. The point was to hit a mooring buoy at first, then a piling on the next dock. One of the teenagers, Dan Daniels' son, Scott, took a three-step running start, threw out to sea, then pitched headlong into the salt water. He was out again in 5 seconds, steam rising off his clothes. Running home, racing through the snowfall, his hair froze into icy tufts. The citizens of San Pedro made their run on Peterson's and cleared the shelves of canned goods. They brought so much snow into the store on their boots that one of the box boys, Earl Camp, stayed busy all afternoon with a mop and a towel, cleaning up after them. Einar Peterson took a box of salt from his shelf and spread its contents outside the door, but two customers slipped despite this. Einar decided to offer free coffee to shoppers and asked one of his checkers, Jessica Porter, who was 22 and cheerful-looking, to stand behind a folding table and serve. At Fisk's Hardware Center, the citizens of San Pedro bought snow shovels, candles, kerosene, kitchen matches, lined gloves, and flashlight batteries. The Torgerson brothers sold out their supply of tire chains by 3 o'clock, as well as most of their ice scrapers and antifreeze. Tom pulled ditched cars free with his freshly painted 2-ton wrecker. Dave sold gasoline, batteries, and motor oil, and advised his customers to go home and stay home. Dozens of islanders stopped in to listen while Dave pumped their gas or put on their tire chains and made grim predictions about the weather. 3-day blow, he'd say. Folks had better be ready. By 3 o'clock, the branches of the cedars were loaded down with snow. When the wind came up, it blew right through them, whirling flurries to the ground. San Pedro's strawberry fields became fields of white, as untouched and flawless as desert. The noise of living things was not so much muted as halted. Even the seagulls were silenced. Instead, there was the wind and the collapse of waves and the withdrawing of the water down the beaches. Everywhere on San Pedro Island, a grimness set in, accompanied by a strained anticipation. Who knew what might happen now that a December storm had started? The homes of these islanders might soon lie in drifts so that only the sloped roofs of the beach cabins would show and only the upper stories of the larger houses. The power might fizzle when the wind blew hard and leave them all in darkness. Their toilets might not flush. Their well pumps might not draw. They would live close to their stoves and lanterns. Yet on the other hand, the snowstorm might mean a respite, a happy wintertime vacation. Schools would shut down, roads would close, no one would go off to their jobs. Families would eat large breakfasts late, then dress for snow and go out in the knowledge that they'd return to warm, snug houses. Smoke would curl from chimneys. At dusk, lights would come on. Lopsided snowmen would stand sentinel in yards. There would be enough to eat, no reason for worry. Still, those who had lived on the island a long time knew that the storm's outcome was beyond their control. This storm might well be like others past that had caused them to suffer, had killed even. Or perhaps it might dwindle beneath tonight's stars and give their children snowbound happiness. Who knew? Who could predict? If disaster, so be it, they said to themselves. There was nothing to be done except what could be done. The rest, like the salt water around them, which swallowed the snow without any effort, remaining what it was implacably, was out of their hands. Beyond. When the afternoon recess was over that day, Alvin Hooks called Art Moran again. The sheriff had left the courtroom for 2.5 hours in order to contact the volunteer fire department and to call out his volunteer deputies, men who could be counted on in times of trouble. Generally, their role was to keep order at the Strawberry Festival and other public occasions. Now they would divide up the island terrain according to the locations of their homes and businesses and assist those stranded on the roads. Art fidgeted in the witness stand for the second time that day. The snowstorm just now preoccupied him. He understood that Alvin's case necessitated his appearing twice at the trial, but, on the other hand, he wasn't glad about it. He'd eaten a sandwich during the 15-minute recess, sat in Alvin's office with a piece of wax paper laid across his knees and an apple on the edge of the desk. Hooks had reminded him to tell his story methodically, to pay attention to those minor details that might seem to him irrelevant. Now, on the witness stand, pinching the knot of his tie together and checking the corners of his lips for crumbs, Art waited impatiently while Alvin asked the judge to admit 4 pieces of rope into evidence.
"Sheriff Moran," Hooks said at last, "I have in my hand 4 lengths of rope of the sort fishermen use for mooring lines. May I ask you to inspect them, please?"
Art took the pieces of rope in his hand and made a show of looking at them carefully.
"Okay,"
he said after a moment.
"Do you recognize them?"
"Yes, I do."
"Did you refer to these pieces of mooring line in your report, Sheriff Moran? Are they the same 4 referred to in your report?"
"Yes, they are. They're the ones I wrote about in my report, Mr. Hooks. These are them."
The judge admitted the lines as evidence, and Ed Soames put a tag on each. Alvin Hooks put them back in Art's hands and asked him to explain where he'd found them.
"Well," said the sheriff, "this one here, marked with an A, came from the defendant's boat. It came off the port side cleat, to be exact, 3rd cleat up from the stern. It matches all his other mooring lines, you see. Matches them all except the one on the port side, cleat 2nd up from the stern. That's this one here, the one marked B. That one was new, Mr. Hooks, but the rest were worn. They were all 3-strand manila lines, with a bowline knotted into one end, pretty well worn down, too. That's how Mr. Miyamoto kept his mooring lines. Bowlined and pretty well worn out, except the one. It was brand new, but had the bowline in it."
"And the other 2? Asked Alvin Hooks. "Where did you find them, Sheriff?"
"I found them on Carl Heine's boat, Mr. Hooks. This one here, the one marked C,"
the sheriff held the line up for the benefit of the jury,
"is exactly the same as every other line I found on Mr. Heine's, the deceased's, boat. You see here, it's a 3-strand manila rope in new condition with a fancy eye braided in at one end, braided in by hand, Mr. Hooks, the way Carl Heine was known to do them. All his lines were braided up in loops. None of them had bowlines." "The 4th line you have there," Alvin Hooks pushed on. "Where did you find it, Sheriff?"
"Found it on Carl Heine's boat, too, but it doesn't match up with the rest of them. Found it on the starboard side, 2nd cleat back from the stern. Peculiar thing is, it does match up with the lines I found on board the defendant's boat. It's pretty well worn, and it's got the bowline in it, just like the other one I showed you, just like all his mooring lines. It looks so much like all the others, it's clear it came from the same set. Worn down, just the same."
"This line looks like the ones on the defendant's boat?"
"Exactly."
"But you found it on the deceased's boat?"
"That's right."
"On the starboard side, 2nd cleat from the stern?"
"Yes."
"And the defendant's boat, do I understand this right, had a new line on the port side, Sheriff, again the 2nd cleat from the stern?"
"That's right, Mr. Hooks. There was a new line there."
"Sheriff," Alvin Hooks said, "if the defendant had tied up to Carl Heine's boat, would these 2 cleats in question line up?"
"You bet they'd line up, and if he, Miyamoto there, had gotten in a hurry to cast off from the deceased's boat, he could have left a line behind tied off to that 2nd cleat.
"I see," said Alvin Hooks. "Your inference is that he left a line behind, then replaced it with that new one, Exhibit B, right there in your hand, replaced it when he got back to the docks."
"It is," said Art Moran.
"Exactly. He tied up to Carl's boat and left a line on it. That seems to me pretty clear."
"But, Sheriff," said Alvin Hooks, "what led you to investigate the defendant in the first place?
Why did you think to look around his boat and to notice something like a new mooring line?
Art pointed out that his investigation into the death of Karl Heine had led him quite naturally to ask questions of Karl's relatives. He'd gone to see Edda Heine, he said, and explained to her that even in the case of a fishing accident, there was a formal investigation to proceed with. Did Karl have any enemies? After Etta, he said, the path to Ole Jurgensen was clear, and from Ole to Judge Lou Fielding's chambers, Art had needed a search warrant. He intended to search Kabuo Miyamoto's boat, the Islander, before it left that night for the salmon grounds. Chapter 18. It had been the judge's bailiff, Ed Soames, who'd answered the door when Art Moran knocked at 5 after 5 on the evening of the 16th and asked to see Lou Fielding. The bailiff wore his coat and held his lunch box in his hand. He'd been on his way out, he explained. The judge was still working at his desk.
"This about Karl Heine?" inquired Ed.
"I guess you heard," the sheriff answered. "But no, this isn't about him, and if you go down to the cafe and say it is, you know what? You'll be wrong, Ed."
"I'm not that way," said the bailiff. "Maybe others are, but I'm not."
"Course you're not," said Art Moran.
The bailiff knocked at the door to the judge's chambers, then opened it and said that the sheriff was present on business he wished to keep private.
"All right," answered the judge. "Send him in."
The bailiff held the door open for Art Moran and stood aside to let him pass.
"Good night, Judge," he said. "See you in the morning."
"Good night, Ed," the judge replied. "Could you lock up on your way out, please? The sheriff here is my last visitor."
"Will do," said Ed Soames, and shut the door.
The sheriff sat and adjusted his legs. He set his hat on the floor. The judge waited patiently until he heard the lock click. Then he looked the sheriff in the eye for the first time.
"Karl Heine," he said.
"Karl Heine," the sheriff answered.
Lou Fielding put his pen down.
"A man with kids, with a wife," he said.
"I know," Art answered. "I went out this morning and told Susan Marie about it."
"Christ,"
he added bitterly. Lou Fielding nodded. He sat morosely with his elbows on his desk, cradling his chin in his hands. As always, he looked to be on the verge of sleep. His eyes were those of a basset hound. His cheeks were creviced, his forehead furrowed, his silver eyebrows grew in fat tufts. Art remembered when he had been more spry, remembered him pitching horseshoes at the Strawberry Festival. The judge in his suspenders, with his sleeves rolled up, squinting and half bent over.
"How is she?"
the judge asked.
"Susan Marie."
"Not good," Art Moran replied.
Lou Fielding looked at him and waited. Art picked his hat up, set it in his lap, and began fiddling with its brim.
"Anyway, I came down to get you to sign a warrant. I want to search Kabuo Miyamoto's boat, maybe his house, too. I'm not sure yet."
"Kabuo Miyamoto," the judge said. "What are you looking for?"
"Well," the sheriff answered, leaning forward, "I've got these concerns, Judge. 5 of them altogether. Number 1, I've got men telling me Miyamoto worked the same waters Carl did last night when this thing happened. Number 2, I've got Etta Heine saying Miyamoto and her son were enemies from way back, an old dispute over land. 3, I've got a piece of mooring line somebody left on Carl's boat, wrapped around one of the cleats. Seems like he could have been boarded, maybe. And I want to take a look at Miyamoto's mooring lines. 4, I've got old Jurgensen claiming both Carl and Miyamoto were out to see him recently about buying his property, which Ole sold to Carl. According to Ole, Miyamoto went away hopping mad, said he was going to have a talk with Carl. And, well, maybe he did. At sea. And things got out of hand."
"And what's the 5th?
Asked Lou Fielding.
"5th?
You claimed to have 5 categories of cause. I've heard 4. What's the 5th?
Oh, said Art Moran.
Horace did a pretty thorough autopsy. There's a bad wound in the side of Carl's head. And Horace said something interesting about it that fits in with what I'm hearing from Ole, and from Etta, too, for that matter, said he'd seen wounds like this one during the war. Said the Japs made 'em with their gun butts. Said they were trained to fight with sticks from the time they were kids. They were trained in kendo, Horace called it. And one of these kendo blows, I guess, would leave the kind of wound Carl has. Now, at the time, I didn't make nothing of it. I didn't even think of it when some of the guys down at the dock said Miyamoto'd been out on Ship Channel Bank last night, same place as Carl. Didn't even occur to me then. But I did think of it this afternoon, when Etta told about all the problems she'd had with Miyamoto, and I thought about it even more after old Jerkinson said his piece. And I decided I'd better follow this lead through and search Miyamoto's boat, Judge, just in case. See what signs there are, if any.
Judge Lew Fielding pinched the tip of his nose.
I don't know, Art, he said. First of all, you've got Horace's off-the-cuff statement regarding a coincidental resemblance between this wound in Carl Heine's head and ones he saw inflicted by Japanese soldiers. Now, does that really point us toward Miyamoto? You've got Etta Heine, who I won't go into, but suffice it to say I don't trust that woman. She's hateful, Art. I don't trust her. And you've got at least 50 gillnetters out in the fog last night, any one of them as contentious as the next when he figures some other guy is cutting into his fish. And then you've got old Jurgensen. And I admit all is interesting. I admit you've got something worth thinking about with Ole, but...
Judge, Art Moran cut in, can I say something? If you think about it too long, we'll lose our chance altogether. The boats will be going out soon.
The judge pulled his sleeve back and squinted at his watch.
5:20, he said. You're right. I've got an affidavit here, the sheriff pressed on, pulling it free of his shirt pocket. I did it up fast, but it's right, Judge. Lays it all out, plain and simple. What I want to look for is a murder weapon, that's all, if there's a chance of that.
Well, replied Lew Fielding, no harm, I suppose, if you do it properly, Art.
He leaned across his desk toward the sheriff.
And for technicality's sake, let's make this move, too. Do you swear that the facts in this affidavit are true? So help you God, do you swear?
The sheriff did.
All right, you bring a warrant?
The sheriff produced one from the opposite shirt pocket. The judge unfolded it beneath his desk lamp and picked up his fountain pen.
I'm going to put this down, he said. I'm going to allow you to search the boat, but not Miyamoto's house. No intruding on his wife and children. I don't see there's any hurry to do something like that. And remember now, this is a limited search, the murder weapon, Art, and nothing else. I won't have you running roughshod over this man's privacy.
Got it, Art Moran said. The murder weapon.
You don't find anything on the boat, come see me in the morning. We'll talk about his house at that point.
All right, said Art Moran. Thanks.
He asked then if he might use the telephone. He dialed his office and spoke with Eleanor Doakes.
Have Abel meet me down to the docks, he said, and tell him to bring along his flashlight.
San Pedro fishermen in 1954 were apt to pay attention to signs and portents other men had no inkling of. For them, the web of cause and effect was invisible and simultaneously everywhere, which was why a man could sink his net with salmon one night and catch only kelp the next. Tides, currents, and winds were one thing, the force of luck another. A fisherman didn't utter the words horse, pig, or hog on the deck of a gillnetter, for to do so was to bring bad weather down around his head or cause a line to foul in his propeller. Turning a hatch cover upside down brought a southwest storm,
and bringing a black suitcase on board meant snarled gear and twisted webbing. Those who harmed seagulls risked the wrath of ship ghosts, for gulls were inhabited by the spirits of men who had been lost at sea in accidents. Umbrellas, too, were bad business, as were broken mirrors and the gift of a pair of scissors. On board a purse seiner, only a greenhorn would ever think to trim his fingernails while sitting on a seine pile, or hand a shipmate a bar of soap as opposed to dropping it into his washbasin, or cut the bottom end off a can of fruit. Bad fishing and bad weather could result from any of these. Kabuo Miyamoto, as he came up the south dock toward his boat that evening, carrying a battery for the islander, saw a flock of seagulls perched on his net drum and stabilizer bars and sitting atop his cabin. When he moved to board, they lofted themselves skyward, 30 or 40 birds, it appeared at first, a clamor of wings, more of them than he imagined possible. 50 seagulls rising from the islander, exploding out of her cockpit. They circled overhead 6 times in arcs that took in the entire breadth of the docks, then settled on the swells to seaward. Kabuo's heart worked hard in his chest. He was not particularly given to omens, but on the other hand, he had never seen this before. He went in and pried up the battery well cover. He slid his new battery into place and bolted the cables to it. Finally, he started his boat engine. He let it run, then flicked the toggle for the #1 pump in order to run his deck hose. Kabuo stood on the edge of the hatch cover and washed gull droppings out the scupper holes. The gulls had disturbed his equilibrium, put him ill at ease. Other boats were pulling out, he saw, motoring past the buoys in Amity Harbor on their way to the salmon grounds. He looked at his watch, 5:40 already. It occurred to him to try his luck at Ship Channel that evening. The good sets would be taken at Elliott Head. When he looked up, a lone gull had perched arrogantly on the port gunwale, 10 feet away and to stern. It was pearl-gray and white-winged, a young herring gull with a wide, flaring breast, and it seemed to be watching him, too. Kabuo reached back delicately and turned the hose valve full open. The water shot harder against the aft deck and ricocheted to stern. When he had fixed in on the gull again, he watched it for a moment out of the corners of his eyes, then shifted his weight to the left swiftly and aimed his hose at it. The stream caught the surprised bird broadside in the breast, and while it struggled to escape from the force of the water, its head smashed against the gunwale of the Channel Star, which was moored in the adjacent berth. Kabuo, the hose still in his hand, was standing beside the port gunwale, staring at the dying gull, when Art Moran and Abel Martinson appeared beside his boat, both carrying flashlights. The sheriff, twice, slashed a hand across his throat. "Cut your engine," he called. "What for?" asked Kabuo Miyamoto. "I've got a warrant," replied the sheriff, and took it out of his shirt pocket. "We're going to search your boat tonight." Kabuo blinked at him, and then his face hardened. He shut the nozzle off and looked the sheriff in the eye. "How long will it take?" he asked. "I don't have any idea," said the sheriff. "It might take quite a while."